It's 8:30. This is the Subcommittee on General Government. It's Thursday, April the 28th. This is an informational hearing to hear public testimony on two subjects, Oregon Public Broadcasting and the Oregon Historical Society. And with the concurrence of the panel, what I'd like to do is to begin with OPB. Senator Devlin, who is chairing a subcommittee this morning, has asked to join us about 8:45, and so I just wanted to let you know that he would be interrupting your testimony, and I'm going to ask him to come forward. I'd like you to have the opportunity to talk for about a half an hour, then leave some opportunity for questions and discussion, and then invite our friends from the Oregon Historical Society to come forward, and have roughly the same time schedule, allow some uninterrupted presentation time, and then the opportunity for the panel to discuss and ask any questions. So, Mr. Bakian, if that's agreeable to you, given that we're the two that are here, that's how we'll proceed.
And if you need to go, I'm happy to listen on my own.
So with that, I'm going to open an informational hearing to take public testimony on Oregon Public Broadcasting and the Oregon Historical Society, and welcome a distinguished former legislator and former co-chair. Ask you to identify yourself for the record and your colleagues, and begin.
Madam Chair, I'm Tony Van Vliet. I live in Corvallis, and I'm here chair of the board of OPB. On my both sides of me are the past, present, and future. We're all chairs of, and to be chairs of OPB, Bill Swindell's past chair, and Doug Tunnell, who is going to be the future chair coming in the middle of this year, and I will be finishing up my term then.
Mr. Van Vliet, just in the interest of full disclosure, I should probably acknowledge that I spent close to 15 years as a board member on OPB and greatly enjoyed my service there. While I never achieved the rank of chair, I just want to get that on the record that I have had a past fiduciary relationship with OPB.
Yes, you have, and we appreciate that very much, Madam Chair. The at the same time, I should say that my sleeping bag is back in the corner there for 17 years in this room, budgeting and in education and human resources. So I feel that this is a very cozy place to be, and glad that you invited us. I'd like to now have them introduce themselves from our board and staff, and it's better that they do that so you can associate name and function with them. So if they just would start off over here, and Mike, you want to start off?
Yeah, Mike Tombrow, and I'll get up the interview.
And I'm going to stop you for one more moment to make sure that I have an opportunity to get all your names on the record, and I've asked our staff to do two things simultaneously, so if you could just hold on for a second. Emory, I think let's let the calls go, and we'll just, they're doing introductions, and I just want to make sure we get their names on the record. Thank you very much. I apologize. Mr. Chair, if you wouldn't mind starting again with your introductions.
Mike? Okay, Mike Tombrow, and I head the engineering department at OPB.
I'm Dan Metzigan. I head the development area.
I think that's it.
Before I start out, we passed out some handouts. I'm going to lean on the fact that being over 75 years old and with my glasses getting weak, I'm going to refer to my little cheat sheet here a little bit, but I learned a long time ago, coming before a committee, that we always ask people just to talk to us. And I'd like to do that this morning, and consequently, I'll be the sort of the lead person, and then have the rest pitch in on the Q&A. I'm fully aware of what you're going through right now as past co-chair Ways and Means, that you've come down, you've got $100 million plus not being able to be matched up. You've got a lot of things still to solve. You're still hopeful that the May 15th forecast will bring in some additional money. The budgets I'm going to talk about today are what we used to call those budgets that came in to the co-chairs that were either had bills that members wanted or what we called the nickel and dime organizations that didn't ask for a lot of money. They were normally ones that ranged from about $200,000 to several million. And they played such an important part of the fabric of the state of Oregon and had such a great return that we did not neglect them over those years. And those two organizations were the Oregon Public Broadcasting System and the Oregon Historical Society. And so if you will look at that chart that I handed out, you will notice that from 1921, actually, until last session, OPB has been continuously funded by the state of Oregon, and also by the 1993 legislation, in which we put in paragraph 12, there was a feeling that there was some obligation on the part of the state to continue financing our operation. And I'm sure that Oregon Historical Society feels the same way. There are two bills that while they're not in your possession, they are important to us because they speak to OPB. One is House Bill 2553 that talks about operational cost, and the other one is Senate Bill 673, which Senator Devlin has been gracious enough to put in, and House Bill 2553, which Representative Ekin has been kind enough to put in for us. They cover two particular different areas. As you know, to operate OPB, it takes just the operational cost of the system itself, takes a little over $4.5 million biennium. We were greatly appreciative of the legislature last time producing the lottery funds that helped us meet the federal requirements for putting out transmitters across the state and stepping into the 21st century with digital broadcasting. OPB had that obligation, as many states do, to upgrade into the digital. Senate Bill 653 or 673 basically continues what we feel is going to be the rest of the obligation, and that is to put the translators out in the field. Most of those, a lot of them, are going to be in the rural areas of the state so people can receive digital. We are your public broadcasting system. We are one of the best in the country. We rank among the top five public broadcasting systems in the country. In the last 18 years, and I'm sure Senator Johnson was a major part of that, helped bring us to being one of the best in both programming and in transmission. Both our radio and our TV programs are top-notch and continuously win awards. The feeling is that we need, basically, as we dropped off the cliff in that horrendous session that most of you went through and lost the funding for the last part of the biennium, it threw us really into pretty much of a tizzy, and we had to do a lot of scrambling to try to keep the wheels on the car. So it's important that as we maintain the electronic highway, which we are, we're the fastest highway in the state when we move information. We are your emergency network. We are your Amber Alert system. And just to maintain those, no money going into the programming or anything else, is that $4.5 million. And you will notice that in the bill, we are only asking for $3.5 million to get back to ground level where we were last biennium. That means we will have to still absorb some cost of the $4.5 million that isn't being met, and we're looking down the gun barrel of a loss of approximately another $500,000 increased power cost, which is coming down the pike at us, not to mention the same thing you're facing, and that is the loss of federal funds, which is also happening, and we stand to lose another $500,000 possibly in federal funding. So it is not a pleasant picture, and I'm sure both the Oregon Historical Society and us, as part of the fabric of the state of Oregon, are looking for a chance to do that. We would prefer not to be one of those organizations that gets a dollar appropriation and have to come in with a tin cup and beg before the emergency board for additional funding. We're hoping that sometime in the next several weeks, funding will be found that brings us into the equation along with the Oregon Historical. So I'm going to stop there, and we will try to answer any questions you have, and both Bill and Doug will have a few comments, and when Senator Devlin comes in, and you'll notice that I've stayed within my time,
I think
we'll
I'm
stop.
Going to invite the comments of your colleagues as we await the arrival of Senator Devlin.
Fine.
I don't know who's going to go first.
Bill,
take it away. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I wanted to highlight...
Swindells, would you mind stating your name for the record, please?
I'm William Swindells. I'm past board chair of Oregon Public Broadcasting and resident of Lake Oswego.
Thank you.
I was, in the time that I was the board chair, we had the digital campaign that was a federal FCC mandate to convert the entire U.S. broadcast system from its old technology to new digital technology. We had the legislature in that session supported us for an allocation of a lottery bond to the tune of, I think, $7 million. That complemented over $15 million of private giving, which made that total campaign possible to meet this federal mandate. The way the mandate was written, if you do, even though a number of people are getting their broadcast by cable now or satellite, if you do not continue to broadcast by their requirements, you lose your broadcast license. So it was an absolute must. We were very pleased. The other thing I wanted to use that as an example is the leverage, is that OPB will always be predominantly privately funded. It has the most loyal donor base per capita of the whole public broadcasting system in the nation. This continuing operating funding, which we lost, again, while not by, I think, probably running at probably less than 10 or 12% of our operating budget, is a leverage, and it allows us to be a true statewide public broadcaster that's expensive. That is the nuts and bolts hardware and software to maintain that system. And we've had to give up many other programs. One of our most popular programs, 7 days, the statewide political analysis, had to be cut in order to maintain the distribution system. So my appeal to you is first to thank you for the past support and emphasize the leverage and how much the people of Oregon get from a modest support of Oregon Public Broadcasting by the state of Oregon.
Thank you very much. And again, if I could ask you to state your name.
My name is Doug Tunnell, and I'm a resident of Newburgh, Oregon, and I'm the current vice chair under Tony's guidance of OPB. I want to thank you very much for hearing us today and coming together and letting us speak about some of the things that we're facing. As vice chair for the last 2 years, I've been involved in a lot of the strategic planning process at OPB, and you may wonder, as we do, what the future might hold for this organization. As we have looked ahead and planned ahead, obviously, we're facing many of very similar challenges as this legislature and the state. And as Tony has described, it's not a pretty picture in terms of funding. But we've come to a plan, a strategic plan, that we really believe is going to reemphasize and refocus OPB on its local and regional mission, on its support for education at many levels, and continue to provide really fundamental services for our children, a safe place for them to go in a very tumultuous media world, as you are no doubt aware. It is a plan that also, along with the legislation before you, will support the infrastructure that exists that allows OPB to reach into every corner of the state and to reach into the little communities, the far rural communities, even the one, for example, where I live, out to the east or along the coast, and provide fundamental services. I think we tend to think of OPB often in terms of prime time and what we see on our television sets at the end of the workday, but there's no doubt it's maybe an untold story. The success of OPB in prime time, it is the most widely watched public television station in prime time of any in the country, and that continues through the last couple of years of budget hardships. But beyond prime time, there's so much else that is given and so much else that is provided. K-12 services for the elderly, services for the very young. And in that way, I think OPB can offer and will offer in the future a real kind of partnership that may bridge a lot of the gaps where funding isn't available. And that's the direction that the organization is going, and I have no doubt that as we move ahead, despite the difficulties, we're going to be there, and OPB will be there for all of us.
Thank you very much, Senator Morissette, and then we'll invite our colleague and good friend, Senator Devlin, up to the table.
Well, I wanted to get a word in before our good friend and colleague, Senator Devlin, gets to the table. Now, I really appreciate your being here, and I listen and watch almost exclusively to public podcasts on the radio and on television. I listen. I get my news basically from the evening reports and so on. Now, I guess my question is, if it is indeed the most watched network and listened to in the state, maybe you didn't say the state, but you said the evening segment is on television, where is the support from the rural area to our rural legislators that this is something that they want us to continue to support? You know, I don't know if that's something that you need to be involved in, but certainly there is an advocacy group out there that I think needs to be very vocal and adamant about supporting at least the minimum level, which is what we're at right now, both the radio and television segments of OPB. That's essential. I guess that's a question. What kind of advocacy groups do you have that represent not just the metropolitan area but the rural areas? That's what's important. So I don't know.
Well, when I was in the legislature, Senator Mike Thorne at that time was a very, very strong advocate of Oregon Public Broadcasting. It was almost a one-man army out in eastern Oregon, and used to ride his truck up at the top of the hill, and he'd tune in, and if he couldn't get NPR, he'd raised Holy Ned with us. And so consequently, that moved us more progressively into eastern Oregon. I'm surprised, just as you are, that they're not eastern Oregon legislators stomping up and down about the fact that, if nothing else, the emergency network, for those who are in favor of being warned ahead of time of another Mount St. Helens or anything else, that they would want to be notified of that in advance. And they have remained somewhat silent. I think probably the reason is that they are so engrossed with the budgetary problems right now that this seems like small potatoes to them.
I'm going to interrupt you at this point. I know Senator Devlin is away from his own committee, and I would invite Senator Devlin to join us at the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We'll come back, because I think that's an important line of questioning, but I just want to be respectful of Senator Devlin's time. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I have prepared testimony here, which I'm going to probably stay on sometimes and digress from sometimes. I'm here this morning to advocate that you consider reestablishing a partnership with Oregon Public Broadcasting, a partnership that has worked for years but has become frayed over the last few years in the face of a very tight state budget. When we think of OPB, I think most of us have very positive feelings. Probably all of us have very positive feelings. And the future of OPB is probably in question here, but it is not obviously going away. The quality may suffer without state support, but it is not going away. But I'd like you to imagine a state without a public broadcasting network. We would probably be the only one. I believe we are the only one that doesn't provide any public support to their public broadcasting network. And I think that when you look at the quality of programming that they provide, the services that they provide to all Oregonians, the fact that they are one of the few elements in any of our programs that brings together urban and rural interests, I think you can clearly see the value. Then, if you look at an area that we seldom look at, but putting on my public safety hat here, OPB also fulfills a very significant and important role. Many of us probably live in areas where cable is available, so we don't really realize that role as much. But OPB is the standard for getting out both Amber Alert and all emergency communications to Oregonians. in many areas in Oregon, it may be the only outlet for getting that communication out to Oregonians, or one of the few outlets to getting that communication to Oregonians. That is a role that would be very difficult for us to replace if OPB did not exist. And I think something that we should clearly recognize, and if I had time here today, which I don't think the chair has time for, we would start to explain some of the difficulties in terms of maintaining some of the transmission capabilities that OPB has and the cost of doing that, and probably some of the reasons why that's important from a public safety standpoint. Also, I think putting on my education subcommittee chair hat, I would tell you that a modest investment in OPB is probably one of the best investments you could make in education in this state in terms of the quality of programming, in terms of the services available to children, and in terms of the services available to Oregonians with special needs, particularly those that are blind. I know that money is tight this session. It was particularly tight last session. But I'd like you to keep in mind that things like OPB, the Oregon Historical Society, the Oregon's Arts Commission, are the things that provide the fabric to this state that make it a very positive place to live. And while they may seem like difficult expenditures to make, I think they provide services to all Oregonians and an important role to all Oregonians that we should respect. When we had to cut some of these programs in both the special sessions and the 2003 sessions, it was not a very good thing to do. When you realize that all those programs combined wouldn't equal 0.1% of our general fund, lottery fund discretionary budget, it seems particularly short-sighted that we would cut those programs to the extent that we have cut them. I know this is a difficult budget season. I obviously know that being on the committees that I am on. But I think some reasonable investment back in OPB would pay dividends for the future, dividends that we would all realize, dividends that all of our friends, family, and children would realize. And I would hope that this committee and that the co-chairs would find some way this session to recommit to OPB a public level of support. And I think that's clearly possible within this budget and should be done.
Thank you very much, Senator Devlin. Any questions of Senator Devlin?
Not a question, but I did just want to thank you for carrying the torch for OPB on the Senate side. I just think it's incredibly important for the presence to be felt in every area of the building.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. There being no questions, we know you have other responsibilities in the building. Thank you for coming in, and I would invite your OPB colleagues to come back and let you go off to your other work.
Thank you, Senator.
May I ask you?
Now, please, fire away. Senator Morrison.
I'm looking at the map, and when we drive to Ontario, Oregon, that where our daughter lives, and it's interesting because we try to stay connected, and we can almost do it all the way by kind of dialing. So it does at least go from here to Burns. I'm not sure about Burns to Ontario, but it's... I guess going back to my original question, I think it's important that we hear from the rural constituents who are out there. Yes.
Senator Morissette, one thing that we kind of struggle with strategically and philosophically, we have between year to year 110,000 to 120,000 members statewide. And we have so far chosen not to politicize that membership, but there's the temptation always exists for us to identify the people in John Day and the people in Burns and to say, you need to write letters introducing. And the ratio in terms of users, there's about one member for every six or five or six television viewers and about one member for every 10 radio listeners. So that we have a broader group, but we have been, again, they have a membership, a loyalty to us for our integrity, and we have not wanted to cross that line yet to try to politicize them.
May I
follow up, Senator Morissette?
Yeah, and I understand that, because at the local level, we have two public broadcast stations, both of which I support. I was on the foundation of one of them. They do have a foundation, and the foundation's job is to go out and raise money. It is a non-political organization, and KLCC is the one I'm talking about, and they're into a building fund to build a new station downtown, which will expand it. And I don't see any reason why an OPB PAC or whatever that is aside from, you guys can't do that, but I think someone should, and it should be up to the people who live out there if they think it's important to rally the support. And so I think there is a way of doing it without you becoming involved.
Well, approximately one-fifth of our membership is out in the rural areas, so it's a sizable amount.
And in their involvement, they become members, you know, $35-$40 at a time, person by person, and then they watch Oregon Field Guide. It's a wonderful sort of relationship, but it is a non-political one.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. Let me begin by saying good morning. It's terrific having OPB at the Capitol. I think you gentlemen and all of your staff and all of the donors to OPB make a tremendous contribution to the state. My family enjoys OPB. My children enjoy OPB. As a matter of fact, I contribute part of my children's development to watching Barney on OPB. But I want to share one of the commentaries I have, and I'd really be interested in hearing your comments on this. I come from probably, I'd say, one of the most rural and remote parts of the state. And one of the commentaries I hear is that the reporting and the shows that are displayed tend to go a little bit to the left, if you will, on a political spectrum, not staying in the middle. And I'm curious if you folks have a comment on that.
Well, you want to comment on
that? We were talking a bit earlier about that, and what we have before us, at least, is an issue that really doesn't address issues of content or of programming. We're looking at a situation where we need to upgrade, under a federal mandate, some technology in order to keep this infrastructure available. I think there's been quite a lot of work and research done. We have some of it here in front of us that indicates that even though it may seem to many people that some of the programming does tend in that direction, it's a very balanced package if you look at it overall.
Might I give just a quick suggestion, if I might? And I truly am shooting from the hip on this one. One of the things that our governor's been very good about is reaching out to key people around the state who are able to help advocate for certain causes that are important to him. And I might encourage OPB to just kind of go out and glean one or two people from the farthest, most remote parts of the state who are key players and bring them on board to OPB. So that way you have an advocate who is around the area, who communicates with a lot of different folks and can advocate for OPB. Because while I shared that commentary, I think it's a real commentary back there. I'm not sure it's accurate, but I think it's a real commentary. And I think there's ways just by some proactive reaching out to certain people out there, you could really help yourselves. So I think you do a great job.
I sat down and sort of made a list of some of the programs that I thought that probably people would be asking questions about. And I think you're probably referring a little bit maybe to Bill Moyers, because some people felt that Bill Moyers was leaning a little bit that way, although a lot of people felt that he was probably as good a journalist as anybody's going to see. But as I went down, I didn't find too many that leaned too far left. In fact, I didn't find any leaned too far right either. But when you stack up Sesame Street, Nova, Frontline, Masterpiece Theater, Antique Roadshow, PBS Kids, History Detectives, The Meaning of Food, American Experience, Nature, National Geographic, Scientific American, Mystery, and Great Performances, I didn't, if you look at those programs, I didn't see too much of a swing one way or another, and I feel that PBS and OPB have been fairly careful in which programs they pick that are representative of really what people like to listen to and are educational. Not to mention what we got a pretty good batting order on NPR also. Between Click and Clack every morning, our most popular show on Saturday morning, along with Wake Wobegon and all the rest of them. You've got BC World Service and Talk of the Nation, all things considered. Pretty square journalism from the standpoint of reporting things as they are. So I
just get a little nervous, though, with those Teletubbies.
and you didn't mention that subversive purple reptile either.
Hey, hey, hey.
You haven't been watching them long enough.
I'm teasing.
Not to be further representative, there was a book out about 3 years ago called Bias, which was about bias in the media, liberal bias in the media. And about 9 out of 10 examples in that book were commercial media. NPR and PBS were almost not mentioned, but that book spurred some surveys, and at the end of the surveys, PBS and NPR were cited by the American public as the most balanced. And maybe in the past you could say, well, between the advent of Fox News and other things, it is seen as the beacon of sensibility.
My last comment, and I'll
follow back. Representative
Smith. I truly agree with that. I just knowing what some of the commentary is, I think you could truly help yourselves by just picking out two or three key people in those remote areas and making sure they serve as your advocates.
See, I'm picking you as the advocate for us.
There's people much more powerful than me back there who are pretty eloquent.
Directly to your point, while 80% of our membership is in the Portland metro area, I think half of our board is from outside Portland metro.
Great.
But it's always Pamela.
As soon as this is done.
One of the questions that I had, particularly in looking at the sheet that you gave us, the appropriations history, and it's one that I've discussed with, I think, at least two of you, where's the $7 million in lottery bonding?
It's not shown as general funds. It's shown as lottery. You would have, if you showed lottery dollars in there, then we would have to put in a special chart as a lottery fund funded. It was not general funds for the operation and maintenance of the system, and that's what all of that is right there.
It's been something that has been a little bit of a wonderment to me, because it says state appropriations. It doesn't say general fund versus lottery.
True.
And I think that there has been, particularly over the course of this last series of cuts, a tendency for OPB to forget that there was this $7 million extension to allow the translator system to get purchased and it placed. And I have wondered why there has been a tendency not to show that relationship at all.
Well, we haven't forgotten it, because that made the possibility of putting that transmitters in, Senator Johnson. So, we could put lottery funds in there as a separate part of the bar. That would certainly be fair to do, and we could do that. But operationally, basically, we have shown the general funds have gone into the operational aspect.
And as chair of that campaign, I apologize if the state wasn't given adequate appreciation. Be assured that as we spoke to our private donors, we gave the state ample credit that campaign was closed through the state's efforts.
I must have missed that part on the TV where the legislature was excoriated for being parsimonious with respect to OPB. I heard a lot about how cheap we were. It's always been a wonderment to me that somehow didn't get included. And I think just in a fair representation of the fact that the state has not abandoned OPB for all the reasons that you have enumerated, that we shouldn't lose track of the fact that opportunity was made available that brought the signal into places of parts of Representative Smith's district.
I think the what you heard on the TV about the fact that there was some consternation about the loss of funds was simply the fact that we were having to lose people, real bodies, out of the general fund part of what we were expecting, and that's really what hurt. The other, which is very valuable, to go out and do the hardware stuff was equally as important, but not as visible as when you lose people.
Senator Morse.
Well, I think Representative Avakian. I'll wait for it.
Then we'll do Representative Avakian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And from when I first wanted to ask you something, a couple other questions popped up, so if the Chair will indulge me for just a minute.
Please.
with respect to the lottery money, the way I interpret that, and please say if I'm wrong, is that that money is really given to you for a specific and a dedicated purpose, as opposed to what you used to receive, which you had a little more flexibility in putting where you thought needed. And that might be the difference between today and 10 years ago. Am I right about that? The other, which is really a statement that you don't have to comment on, that I think is always so interesting about what some people have as a misconception about liberal OPB tendencies is, and I don't know the statistics, but I would guess that in sheer minutes dedicated to religious history and analysis of different spiritual beliefs within a community, that you probably top the list of anything that's provided in network programming.
I have to go back and look, but if you look at like the Dead Sea Scrolls and some of the things like that, yes,
it just seems
right up there in some of those programs.
Yeah, but and this will lead to a question, Madam Chair. One of the things I would like you to comment on, and when our friends from the Historical Society come up as well, something that I observe and feel about where we are heading, not just with OPB. Is that over the last maybe decade that this body has moved very much towards the elimination of programs that we would consider cultural or artistic. And we've seen it not only in public education where you have, for instance, the No Child Left Behind Act that requires only math, science, and English, and where we have many, many districts throughout the state that have eliminated music programs, art instruction programs, no longer have theater programs. A new middle school that was being planned to be built in my district, the initial plans did not even have a theater or auditorium. Now, it took us a year to change that, but we eventually changed it. And I don't see that trend changing. You add on to that the difficulty that cultural programs such as the organ, the ballet, and the opera, and the Keller Auditorium, where by necessity ticket prices have gotten as high as they've gotten, which eliminates the masses from the exposure to arts in our community. That one of the only avenues remaining that is free, that is of high quality, accessible to every child and every family is you.
Good point. Well, let me comment.
I'm almost done.
Okay.
Which would lead me to think, setting the lottery dollars aside, that as we decrease those budgets and make other things inaccessible in a society, that you should look like that. And I guess what I'd like you to comment on is, one, if you share my perspective, and if you do, if you could offer some explanation as to why you see that trend happening and what can be done to shift it.
Well, I can only go back to one instance that in 1993, well, actually probably in the 91 session, we were establishing what we called an EdNet, in which schools would purchase programs, of which we've got a tremendous library of educational materials that go along those lines, plus joint ventures with other people. In fact, we have a joint venture now with Oregon Historical Society on the Lewis and Clark venture. EdNet was lost. It was lost in 93 and in 95. It fell off the radar screen. And we started to drift into what we call a pay-as-you-go, fee-structured legislature. We raised fees to take care of the shortfalls. We started in 1980 to do that when we went in the tank, but more so in 1990. And everything started to look at as a pay-as-you-go. And if it didn't pay as a go, it fell off the screen, rather than the common good aspect of it, which was what a lot of people felt ought to be followed. So when EdNet went, much of your school broadcasting went. What little is being done through EDS is now, I don't know what the full force of it is, but they have the availability to much of our educational material. And we've got a wonderful bank of educational material, and we're producing educational material nationwide for nationwide sources. So the matter is exactly right. When you're doing those, if you're worried about the loss of those kind of things in society, that's when you should be pumping dollars into it, even though they're small dollars for great return.
I would add that, you know, it's not that OPB or any television broadcast can replace being in a symphony hall or visiting the art museum or any of those direct personal experiences. But OPB does offer the possibility to kind of bridge that gap, that lack. And I think that's why it's so special, that it can fill, not entirely, but the next best thing, exactly what you're describing.
Representative Smith.
Adding on Representative Watkins' comments, if you look at that funding chart, it's a real commentary on the legislature that we zeroed it out during our tough time here. But I don't think this tough time was any worse than what occurred in 1981 when the legislature still funded OPB at $3.6 million, which probably in today's dollars would equate to probably, what, 10?
Look at 91. 91, I was chair to put into effect ballot measure 5 and school equalization, and we didn't leave OPB off the deck.
Yeah. It's a real commentary on this building, and I think Representative Avakian's point of if there's ever a time for that additional funding to be in place, it's now. Not trying to put undue pressure on our co-chairs, but nonetheless, I think it is a commentary.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. Another aspect is the commercialization of OPB and corporate broadcast, and I find myself now turning the dial down or the volume down when they go through all of the credits, but there's a fine line between out-and-out commercials and acknowledging your sponsors and what they do. And that's good and bad because it does bring in funding, but then, pretty soon you get to the point where you don't want to listen to the commercials anymore. And so I'm not asking you to comment on
that. Oh, boy, we got comments on that.
This is a huge compliment to all the people of Oregon that appreciate OPB. We are the best supported per capita public broadcaster in the nation. When we receive the download from NPR or PBS, we cannot remove the underwriting that's gone into those streams. PBS, under pressure of the rank and file, keeps expanding their windows from, I think it was 10 seconds, and it was 30 seconds, and they're fighting, Maynard Orman can speak better to it, fighting for like a minute, which we're just, we don't, in Oregon, we can afford not to do it that way, so, but all we can control is the underwriting, local underwriting we sell, and we keep, again, if the best example of television and radio, we keep those to a minimum, but those are getting tacked on top of the larger underwriting messages that are fed to us that we don't have control over. And unfortunately, not other states have the private support that OPB has, and they are the ones that are supporting the expansion of the commercials.
Ordering on infomercials.
Yeah.
Well, Mobil Oil, if they didn't get a 60-second spot, threatened to pull their support away from Masterpiece Theater, which is one of the leading programs. So that's the kind of push-pull that's going on in public broadcasting, which makes it tough.
As we conclude here, I think we would be remiss not to ask you to comment on radio. I think we've been very clearly focused on the television signal, but my service on the board was just concluding as the switch from a more music-oriented format was occurring, and you were focusing more on news. I was one of the people that was wrong in that argument. I had hoped to stay more with the music format, and I think the news format has turned out to be very successful, and I would just invite your comment on that as we wind up.
The most widely listened to broadcasting on the radio in the Portland metropolitan area and in Southwest Washington. It's been completely successful and continues to be to this day.
For some of us that spend an inordinate amount of time in our vehicles driving all over the place, your signal is the only drive time news that's worth anything.
Yeah.
And you have more than just little snips. You've actually got coverage of topical issues, and I think it's much appreciated. And I'm saying on the record that I was wrong. It was a good thing to go to the news format.
Well, it's going to be in a constant state of change. We're seeing at the national level much, much more emphasis being put on to the youth segment because they're worried about the fact that the 20 to 35-year-olds are drifting away from some of the networks and even from the commercial networks. They're going to things like satellite radio so they can dial through 150 stations and get the kind of rock that they want. And so it's going to be a very dynamic time in the next 10 years in public broadcasting to maintain the quality that we really want and have. Maybe we're just hoping that if there's 100 or 200 stations, people will get oversaturated with spinning their dials and come back to just good public broadcasting.
Senator Morsette.
One last thing. I live in an area in Lane County where we have three excellent public radio stations, actually four. We have KFMY. Our KWAX, I mean, which is a good classical music station, and they are exclusively music, and I support them and listen to them half the time. We also have a KMTR, which is a high school public station, and they play high school tape music, and that's very popular, and they're competing for the dollar. And then we have Lane Community College, LCC, which is a wonderful station that is kind of a mixture. And then the public broadcast that I also listen to, which is mostly, well, it's a mix. But it seems to be expanding, and there are more of these public broadcast stations coming on the market, and they're competing for the dollars, but they all seem to be successful. So there's something there that is appealing to a wide range of people.
The rule of thumb that drove OPB to some of its changes is that single format is the most successful. Maynard Norm, I was always quick to say we're both members of KBPF, which is the classical, all classical music station in Portland. And the community is better served if the community was good to step up to support that multiple stations as opposed to expecting all things from one station.
Thank Senator, Representative Smith and Representative Avakian, and we will begin the next segment of our presentations.
Two questions. One, could you please ask your producer of Oregon Field Guide to stay out of Wallowa County? and please pass on the message. I did not appreciate the segment on the Winneha River, one of Oregon's last great unknown fishing holes.
Yeah.
Okay. We did not appreciate that.
This is the downside of outreach.
Exactly.
You wouldn't go so far as to condition a vote on keeping Wallowa County a secret.
Just the Winneha River.
Okay.
You can come to other parts. Go to Wallowa Lake. Yeah. The second, I would truly be appreciative if Click and Clack ever come to Portland, just to be notified when they do come.
You bet.
Thank you.
Representative Avakian, and you'll have the last word.
All right, thank you. I want to follow up on the question regarding advertising and the need. I had my staff bring this down because I just thought it was so interesting. I just got back from Tennessee a couple weeks ago. Here's a picture of a bus in Arizona. The second page had them in Tennessee. A school bus with an advertisement on the side of it, Bell Ford, asks you to stay in school. It's a Ford dealership. Because what half a dozen states in the country have gone to is placing advertisements on the side of their school buses in order to raise money and putting billboards on the side of their school in order to raise money. And what the notion of OPB needing to have a commercial or in some way look for money, I think is just a horrible, horrible side effect or symptom of the fact that legislatures, and not just us, but throughout the country, are failing to take care of the entities that are supposed to provide a public service. And when we cut that off, there is nowhere else to go. And what it does is it destroys the purity of the system. And I think we are one very, very small step away from this in Oregon. And the only way to prevent that, I have absolutely no criticism or blame if you need to go find your money somewhere else because you're not getting taken care of in the way you should.
soft drink machines.
I was going to say that. Thank you.
Yeah.
I would invite any closing comments, and then thank you for coming.
Well, we just are greatly appreciative to have this time to be with you and express our feeling and hope that we're not one of the tin cup gang, that we would that you can find some source of funds for us, and we would be greatly appreciative.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you,
sir. Thank you.
Now we'd invite up to the witness table of the Oregon Historical Society, Dr. Pierce, and whoever else is joining you for this presentation. Our special guest, Norma Paulus, whose long distinguished career in Oregon government is well known by everybody. Thank you very much. You do us honor to be here today.
My pleasure. You run a very nice committee.
We're very proud of our chair.
She keeps us in line.
Well, and I would just like to comment for those people that are listening. Representative Krupp sent a note down. He's attending a family funeral today. And Senator Morris has been called into some of the budget negotiations, and so they are attending business and not here today. So with that, Dr. Pierce, good morning.
Thank you.
Again, in the interest of full disclosure, I have a relationship with Oregon Historical Society. I'm very pleased to follow both my father, now deceased, and my mother, who served her full complement of board service. I was honored to be asked to continue a family tradition and serve on the board, and just want to disclose that at this point.
Thank you very much, and we deeply appreciate the service that your family's given to the state and to OHS over the years. Madam Chair, I'm John Pierce. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Historical Society. I'm near the end of my second year. I've been in Oregon about 4 years. My wife and I both have family that have been in Oregon for many generations, and including my wife's family, who is from Gillum County. The Weatherals is the name. That was her mother's maiden name. And we are delighted to be in Oregon and back home again after being around the country a lot. My wife is elementary principal in West Lynn, and actually had the pleasure of having Senator Devlin in her school last week. So we're deeply involved in the community already. I'm joined by Bob Gregg, who's Executive Vice President of FEI Company in Hillsboro, and who is President of the Board of Directors of the Oregon Historical Society, a Portland native. And as you indicated, Norma Paulus, distinguished native of Burns, and former Secretary of State and State Superintendent of Public Schools. So thank you. This is my first time before the Oregon Legislature, although I did many years ago work on the Hill in D.C. for Tom Foley and Frank Church. So it's a process and a venue that that I honor. We're here this morning to request support for funding of the Oregon Historical Society. We have been funded by the state since our incorporation in 1898 until the most recent biennium. The last two biennia in which we were funded, we received slightly more than $1.2 million for the biennium. We were founded in 1898, incorporated by the state, and our goal and our mission, defined by the state and also by our own statements, is to be the protector and the repository of the most significant treasures of Oregon history. Our mission statement says, "The Oregon Historical Society encourages the understanding and promotion of Oregon history by the collection, documentation, interpretation, and preservation of historical artifacts and knowledge about the past." In pursuing that mission, we will have over 2.5 million photos and negatives. These include prints by the famous photographer Carlton Watkins, who took a number of photos of Columbia River Gorge in the 1860s. And I brought one with me so that you could see that. This print was made, and it's called a mammoth print, where the prints are the same size as the negative. And this is of... I had to sign my life away.
You can use the end of either one of these tables.
Neither this nor
the director of the librarian or the director of our artifact collection.
Should we just go walk over to it?
Yeah.
It was taken in the 1860s.
That's extraordinary.
We have 70 of these, four of which are shared by no one else in the country. The Getty Museum came to our site about a month ago, and they're putting together a catalog of these prints, an inventory nationwide. And they say that we have ones that they have seen themselves. From a value perspective, they're priceless. I mean, on a market, they might go for $400,000 or something like that.
A piece, yes. Wow. It's called The Passage of the Dalles.
Would you mind, Dr. Pierce, I'm going to break my own rule here and interrupt your testimony to ask questions. What special curatorial techniques need to be employed to preserve a photograph of that age and that value?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing, you don't touch them. The other thing is you keep them away from light, and then you keep them in very secure facilities. We have a state-of-the-art in one of the Portland suburbs. We have a state-of-the-art facility where we have vaults and we have high security. We have modern environmental controls, and so the main thing is to protect them against the light and to keep hands off.
Can you estimate your annual cost in the curation and preservation of the 2 million photographs entrusted to you?
Well, for just for the photographs, I'd say it's probably $150,000. And one of the things we're doing in order to make available things like this that you can't have people pawing through is we're engaged on a major technology project where we digitize images of them, and then those will be available to people. So people will be able to see these without placing them in jeopardy. So we also have 8 million feet of film. Probably have home movies of you, Senator Johnson.
That's horrifying.
Oh, man. You want my support. I don't want to see those.
You've got the website. Man.
There's the wall. Bring them in.
Many of our film clips are used by OPB, and as the gentleman ahead of us said, we're engaged in several collaborative projects with them. We have 35,000 rare books. One of them, as it says in the comments, is the first authentic history of the Lewis and Clark Expedition, written by Nicholas Biddle, published in 1814. I could not bring that one. We have 25,000 maps, some going back to the 1500s. We have over 8,000 oral history tapes, including many of state legislators. We have 12,000 linear feet of manuscripts, and I brought some of the more interesting ones with me. And they're in here. I have...
You come down in a Brinks car?
We decided to go incognito. I've got one by Meriwether Lewis.
May I show this?
Yeah, please do. This is the Meriwether Lewis one. Which one is that you have, Norm?
Wow.
This is Fremont.
That is absolutely.
That's a letter from John Fremont to John McLaughlin.
So this is actually Meriwether Lewis's hand.
You bet.
Wow.
Here is here's one by Samuel Clemens, known as Mark Twain.
I can't read it. I'm too far away.
Oh, no, this is the pay. This is...
Is that the Lewis one?
This is Meriwether Lewis requesting this pay.
Right.
December 14th, 1807. On the 5th day of January, 1808, or thereafter, on site, my first of this tenor, north and south, date remaining unpaid, pay to William William King and ordered the sum of $188. Now, this is $188.68, and it's the payment that he's requesting for his service by leaving the expiration, which they never paid him.
And that was written when Lewis was the governor of the Louisiana Territory.
Just like government to leave you with the tin cup.
Yeah.
That's really remarkable.
Thank you.
I stumbled over those two words because they're abbreviations.
Really,
I'm not sure
the
what
handwriting.
That's gorgeous.
Now we have.
Okay, now.
Thank you.
We have another artifact of even more significant value in this box right here.
And again, I'd invite you to use that end of the table.
Okay.
If it makes the presentation easier.
And Representative Smith will love this. This is the first.
Oh, look at that.
American flag hand sewn in Oregon by one of his ancestors.
That's my great 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 grandmother sewed this flag.
Wow.
So you can see the how the stars are sewn on it and
wow.
But did that come down at the right time? That's amazing.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
And she didn't skip a stitch.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
We can't. You can tell that it's in some jeopardy. So we can,
because
we want to take it out and sort of hold it up, but it's too big for that, and it would probably not be good for it.
Thank you so much for bringing that down.
You know what might be interesting, if you are able to stay, would be to have that on the floor today, and for you to be able to show the legislature that flag. That's a remarkable Oregon artifact.
Would you be able to stay till 11? Not take it out of the box, but just be able to.
Yeah,
hold.
I'd have them carry it if I were
you. No, I would. You know what's amazing is our family came to Oregon at the very beginning, and that's just one of a whole slew of artifacts. And our family, at some point, will be turning over a lot more stuff to the Historical Society.
Madam Chair, can I make a plug on something very quickly related to that?
Please, plug away.
And I haven't had a chance to sit down with all of you about this yet, but we have a bill in the legislature to create a Capital History Center near the Rotunda so that visitors have a place to come in and see some of the beautiful artifacts that we have, including the Oregon Constitution, some other things, passed off the House floor yesterday, and I'm certain we'll have no trouble in the Senate. So this will be starting soon. This, especially because of its connection to you, is exactly the kind of thing that at least I was envisioning we would be able to provide to Oregonians. We have 350,000 a year that come through the front doors of this building. And having something like this in the rotunda for people to experience is just invaluable. Invaluable.
You're right. One of the things we've been doing for years is preparing the exhibits for the state here in the Capitol.
The glass along the
right.
The hearing room hallway.
And we're now talking about what will be the theme for the next one that we put in. We have in our collection. I can touch this because it's a replica. It's the branding iron of Meriwether Lewis that he carried with the Corps of Discovery. And it's part of the National Traveling Exhibition that is going around the country and will be at our place in November. We're the only West Coast venue for that, and it'll go from our place to the Smithsonian. I might add that we have a limited number of these that have been made, and they're on sale in our store. So if you're interested in having one.
After you get done with your presentation, I would very much like to bring you back to the Lewis and Clark exhibit and the costs associated with mounting that.
Great. And two other things I brought are very small, and they're coins. One of them is a 1849 $10 gold beaver coin that we have. And the other one is a penny, the flip of which was used to decide whether that big city to the north was to be Boston or Portland.
This is the actual
penny. This is it.
This is the actual penny. Now, it doesn't say Portland and Boston on the two sides. So...
Wow.
And so we're Portland and not Boston because of that.
This is this beaver coin is an exquisite coin.
Isn't that gorgeous?
Very valuable.
You notice Mrs. Paula standing there making sure that
it's into a box.
I don't want to balance the budget.
Yeah, balance the budget with this coin.
Please don't tell us to sell it.
Well, I won't run you through the statutory or legislative history on it all, except to say that we were funded initially in 1899 and were funded continually until 2003. We now are only one of nine state historical societies in the country that does not have state funding. But we still continue to engage in a number of services to the state, including, of course, this incredible collection of artifacts and that we hold, including almost 100,000 of them, artifacts in addition to all of the other things that I mentioned to you.
I didn't ask you this question ahead of time, so you probably are not prepared with an answer. But I was curious, when you think about the budget of the archives building, a building that was built at state expense, it has personnel in it at state expense, houses all of our written word, versus the now zeroed out expenditure for anything that has to do with the curation, preservation, display, education of any of our physical artifacts. Yeah. I think it would be very interesting to know how much money is spent archiving our written word and the fact that we're spending no money now curating our physical treasures.
Right. Yeah. And we're a nonprofit, and there's a reason that word's there is that we're efficient and lean, we work hard, and we still conduct a lot of the required activities. We feel required in an ethical and moral sense in terms of preserving the history of the state. And we do that with a number of really high-quality staff who are dedicated and have been with us for many, many years.
But our 100,000-square-foot storage facility has how many staff?
It has one full-time person for the maintenance of it, and then we have processing people who work out there as well. In fact, in one of our recent budget cuts after the loss of state funding, we had to reduce the staff out there.
Sorry, we keep interrupting your testimony. Seeing these goodies is so thrilling.
Yeah, it is. It's wonderful. And I'm just I'm on the floor all the time hunting for things to look at like that. And also, as part of my role as executive director, I participate in state activities, including the Oregon Heritage Commission, the Cultural Trust, Lewis and Clark Bicentennial in Oregon. You may not know this, and I didn't when I took the job, but as executive director, I'm the official appointing authority and permanent secretary of the Oregon Geographic Names Board. And that has some special relevance to places like Wallowa, where there are issues about naming of creeks and things.
Fishing hole for you.
I'm interested in that because when you said that, there was some flash in my mind. I had my wife's from Walla Walla, and I had my honeymoon up at Wallowa Lake. And one of the great events of my honeymoon was I lost my fishing rod in Little Sheep Creek.
Did you?
Yeah, because I was thinking about it.
Well, I got to tell you, I've got to interrupt in the spirit. When I watched that OPB special, literally they panned in right to where I fish.
Is that right?
I mean, you couldn't have asked for anything more.
Well,
what are they doing?
I want to say that even though we're located in Portland, we have strong connections all over the state. We have 5,000 individual family or corporate members. We have over 160 affiliate organizations throughout the state, as far away as Jordan Valley and Ontario and Klamath and the rest. We did a recent market survey. Over 200,000 people access our website. That was by their count. And when we count the hits, we get 17,000 a month on our on our homepage and about $150,000 a month on different places. A lot of that is because of something that Norma could talk about if she'd like more, which is our Oregon History Project, where we are taking the artifacts and the materials that we hold in trust for the state, digitizing them, integrating them into K-12 educational materials, curricula, narratives, bibliography, lesson plans that we develop with teachers that are designed to meet state standards for history. And so we have people all over the state who do that. And as I indicated, we're the only West Coast venue of the Lewis and Clark National Bicentennial Exhibition. We expect 150,000 to 200,000 people to come for that. Only 4 months we have it. I'd like to say that we do a great job as well in doing all of this. As I indicate in the text of this, David Hackett Fisher, who just won the Pulitzer Prize for his book on Washington Crossing the Delaware, was a Marco Hatfield lecturer this last fall, and we were stunned and moved by, without a stimulus, he stood up in front of 500 people in the pavilion and said, I'm so delighted to be here. I've been at all these historical societies all over the country, and there are only two that have the energy and the commitment and the quality that stand out above the rest, and one of them is right here at the Oregon Historical Society. And so we were delighted at that, and Oregon should be proud of it. And our activities win awards, national awards, and if we don't get funding, we will have to look over the next biennium at reducing our activities. I must say that we have had a wonderful board over many years, and because of that, they were conservative in their commitment of our funds, and so we've been able to move through this transition with a combination of use of our seed corn and some reduction in programs. But the string's going to run out here pretty soon. We are engaged in a detailed, intensive strategic planning process to try to find alternative funding strategies, but we do need state funding to make that work. The final comment I'd make is that, as it says here, we believe that we're engaged in a fundamental, essential activity to the quality of the culture of Oregon, and one which has been expected and received by the state of Oregon for over 100 years. And we hope you'll join us in sharing that mission continues. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Pierce. Any questions for Dr. Pierce? Ms. Leonard Morissette.
I couldn't resist bringing.
I saw that when you.
Well, I happen to live in Portland. I arrived in 1953 and we left in 1960, and so I'm intrigued with the article Organizing Portland. This is 2003, the fall of 2003, and I saved these and I went back and looked at this again. I didn't even know you were going to be here, but it's interesting because I was in Portland at the time, and there was a lot going on. This is organized crime, municipal corruption, and the Teamsters Union, which I happened to belong to at the time. And
so did my dad.
And I didn't see any of this, although I knew Dave Beck. You know, that all happened during the time, but this is absolutely fascinating. And I need to go into more detail. I guess I need to find more information, but the location of the Rose Garden, I can remember the big dispute because some people want to put out in Delta Pond and the Delta area, but I knew there was a real estate thing going on at the time, and there was no doubt it was going to be located where it was because of all of that. This goes into that in some detail, and this is the kind of thing that I think is really, really important for people to have.
Well,
really important.
The guy who wrote that is working on a book, so that'll be much more
good.
Detailed.
I will read the book.
And a lot of information for that comes out of our own archives.
Well, this is an example of, I think, priceless kinds of information
Thank you.
There.
We
and
are very
other things.
We're very proud of the OHQ. It's a signal light for the whole thing we do.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. I truly appreciate you taking the time to bring that down. That has truly made my session. It really has. Our family's talked about it. I've seen the pictures, the newspaper articles.
Never seen it before?
It's the first time I've seen it.
Oh, really?
And so I truly, truly appreciate that. If I cross a line here, I apologize. I almost feel ashamed for this body that we did zero out funding for the Historical Society, and I feel ashamed by the fact that we have several departments that we call community development in their title, and once again we've zeroed out funding, and I think it's incumbent upon us to do all we can to step up to support the Historical Society as part of that community development. And I don't mean to cross a line in those comments, but I feel very strongly about that. And I've waited for a long time to be in a position to work to be able to take those type of stands. And I just share with you that's probably one of those stands I will be taking. So I apologize if I've crossed a line by making that statement.
You haven't at all.
But that is one of the things I will be doing, and I just want that on the record.
Thank you. Representative Ivaki.
Well, I want on the record, too, what it means to me, what you just said. I don't think of funding the Historical Society as just funding the Historical Society. I think of it as funding something that is really the posterity for all of Oregon. And just like my comments with regard to OPB, there is really nowhere else to go in this state in order to preserve historical artifacts and documents, with the exception of maybe the archives building, for generations and maybe centuries to come, just to ensure your survival to do that. And it's got very little to do with you as an organization. It's got everything to do with the state.
And
so I agree with you. I can think of almost nothing except public education, maybe, that is as important as preserving the history and culture of who we are.
Particularly with the relationship that I think is now 100 years old, and a moral and ethical obligation, wherein the state asked you to undertake the preservation and curation and intellectual study of our tangible history, and have had this partnership, and it was last session when we let go of your hand, and I think have come across a line that we shouldn't have done. That precious flag, those magnificent photographs that are art as well as the history of our state and tribal nations, those things don't take care of themselves, and we have gone to this enormous expense to preserve our written and video history of what occurs in this building. And yet just making sure that that beautiful flag maintains its physical integrity, it has to be cared for. It has to be in the right kind of box, covered in the right kind of tissue. And that's just one example of the thousands of artifacts that families, Oregonians, have entrusted to you in the belief that they will be kept faithfully. And if we cripple your ability to act as stewards for these things entrusted to you, and you've said that several times in your testimony, given to the state in trust, and we violate that trust because of our parsimony here, I think we have done an enormous disservice to ourselves, the history that preceded us, and the Oregonians that will come in the future who are relying on us to make sure that this tangible record exists.
Thank you for saying that.
Can I just make one
suggestion? Representative Ivaki and Senator Morissette. Look,
without overstating it, too, I think it extends beyond our borders, because things happened in the formation of this territory and this state that are of great consequence to the nation, and which is why I admire so much your work and everybody's on the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial. And I think we have an obligation, and I wouldn't mind if after Senator Morissette is done, if you would comment on it, how you see our obligation to the other states and to the nation's capital in preserving American history.
No, go ahead and comment on that.
Well, it's the Lewis and Clark focus underscores the pivotal place that this country, this part of the country, plays in what made the United States what it is today. And it's both real and it's symbolic. It's real in terms of the resources and the people and the energy that have gone in to building a strong infrastructure for the country. It's symbolic in the sense of what it took for the kinds of people that came here to make it work in the face of those kinds of challenges and hardships. Not just Lewis and Clark, but the Oregon Trail and the people who came here, like my parents from the Depression were Dust Bowl refugees who came out here and built a place that for many people in the country have become a model to which they aspire for the quality of life, the quality of government, the kinds of civic culture and civic engagement. And so I think there's a lot we have within our resources, within our grasp at OHS, that helps people understand that. And there are people who come from all over the country or all over the world to Oregon to find out how we do it and how we got that way. So that's my answer.
And if I could, Oregon is a very...
Would you identify yourself for the record, Mr. Gregg?
I'm Bob Gregg, president of the board, director of OHS. And one of the things I'm proudest of is we have just in July opened up an exhibit at our facility in Portland called Oregon, My Oregon. And it's a $3 million exhibit. If you haven't seen it, I strongly recommend it. It does just an amazing job of trying to capture what Oregon is, why it is. So from people outside the state, and particularly for kids, for my kids, I mean, it's just, I can take them there and try to help them understand why Oregon is the way it is today. And they're absolutely fascinated by it. And it's, to me, that's why we're here. And, you know, $3 million exhibit, totally funded by private donors, and, you know, thank goodness for them. But one of our big issues is we can get people to donate for things like that. And we can get people to donate for the Lewis and Clark Exposition. It's very difficult to get them to donate to keep the doors open at our storage facility.
Which is where we keep these things.
Senator Morshet.
My suggestion is that I think this is a wonderful opportunity, once in a lifetime, once only, for you to go with them up to the dome. Don't take it out of the box. Open the lid, and the flag will have been here with you for posterity.
Thank you.
I think that's a great opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, let us move through the rest of the testimony. So in the hour before Representative Smith has to go to the floor and you'll accompany him, we want to hear both from Mr. Gregg and certainly from my good friend, Mrs. Paulus.
Okay. Well, I've identified myself, so Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. And my written comments are included on your desk. So I will try to paraphrase in the interest of time. I want to make three primary points. First point is, to the outside world, most people look at OHS as business as usual. You know, everything's just fine. For those of us on the board and on the staff, we are in a bit of a major crisis mode. We have had significant staff layoffs because of our budget issues. We're running this place on the backs of a very, very limited number of people.
Mr. Gregg, I apologize for interrupting you. Would you mind moving the microphone closer to you?
Absolutely.
So we can get your remarks in their totality?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
My apologies. So my first point is, to the outside world, it looks very much business as usual. Right now, through continuous layoffs and everything that the board has had to do to try to close the budget gaps, we've got a staff that has not seen a pay raise in over 4 years. We've cut the staff probably at least three or four rounds of layoffs. We're at the point where we are down to bare minimum, clearly. As board president last week, I had to report to the rest of the board that our deficit for this year was over $2 million. As John said, we are able to do that because we have been very, very fiscally responsible for a long time, and we're using our reserves to fund these deficits. Unfortunately, those reserves are down to the point where we're down to the endowment, and we cannot eat into the endowment. So we're at the point where we start cutting programs in a big way, or that's part of the strategic plan that John talked about. We've got to redesign ourselves as to what we're going to be in the future. Point two is the budget crisis brought on by the elimination of the state funding has already had some major impacts, the biggest one of which is we have had to eliminate our oral history program. The last oral history we took was of Senator Hatfield, which was just an outstanding piece of work. And for me to sit here and think about having a gap in our oral history
you know, I'm convinced that when the people of the state of Oregon learn that we're no longer doing oral histories, that they will find a way to fund it privately some way, but because they will not stand for it. But the idea of having a significant gap in a period of time, we're going to lose some oral histories that we certainly do not want to see happen. And lastly, John made all the right arguments as to why funding OHS is the right thing to do. I'd like to make the argument that it's the only sensible thing to do from a business standpoint. I'm executive vice president of a technology company in Hillsboro, and you know, I understand how important it is for the cultural fabric of the community, both for the business and for the people that we bring into this business from out of state and other places. They look for the culture of the community and how tight that is. As John said in his remarks, the Oregon Historical Society is the only West Coast venue for the National Lewis and Clark Exposition. We expect over 200,000 visitors to this. It'll be one of the biggest tourist attractions in the state of Oregon for many, many years. Right now, we expect 30 to 40,000 of those people to be from out of state, just because people, you have no idea how many Lewis and Clark buffs there are out there. And we're going to get a major push of tourism in for this thing. Using POVA's, the Portland, Oregon Visitors Association statistics, they're estimating with that volume of people, the economic impact will be something in excess of $25 million. Now, as I look back, and I've been on the board now for 8 years, and in our current deficit position and without state support, I can confidently tell you that the board would never have agreed to take on this project. There's no possible way we could have done that. As a point of reference, in Philadelphia, where the national exhibit just closed, state and local government picked up 100% of the cost of that exhibit. In Oregon, it's on the backs of donors that we can attract to do this, and we're right in the middle of that fundraising campaign right now, and we've got a long way to go. So we're clearly not asking for you to fund this exhibit, but we are asking for your help in helping us keep the programs going forward.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gregg. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. It's very good having you at the Capitol.
Pleased to be here.
I'm going to ask you a very leading question.
Okay.
I'm assuming the Lewis and Clark activity that's going to occur is going to benefit all of Oregon?
As far as I'm concerned, absolutely.
And it's a leading question. I'm assuming Lewis and Clark started on the east part of the state and came right on down the river and all those counties.
There are a variety of ways that we're involving people from around the state. Obviously, that exhibit can only be in one place. But one of the things we're doing as part of the fundraising is trying to subsidize or eliminate costs to like 25,000 school children from around the state so that we can bring them in. We also, in terms of the Oregon History Project, which is the online education program, there's a Lewis and Clark segment on that, so which we hope will both inform into the school districts, but also, and that was funded by Weyerhaeuser Corporation, by the way, or the foundation, but will also act as an attractor to bring people to see that, and then we're working with the tribes from around the state as well.
I've got to share with you, if I may follow up.
Thanks.
You know, our family, every year we take a major vacation. We go somewhere, whether it's Orlando or somewhere. This year we're heading to St. Louis in our trailer, and we're going to take the Lewis and Clark Trail all the way back up to Astoria. And our family has been listening to tapes, and we've got it mapped out. And if the legislature will allow us to get out of here before mid-August, that's our plan. And, you know, we're just one of, like you're saying, 30 to 40,000 families or entities that are going to come, and they're going to spend money in Oregon. They're going to learn about Oregon. What an opportunity we have.
May I just add to that in my association with the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial, and I chair the board of the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial Organization in Oregon along with Dr. Pearson, Norma, and many others, the kinds of tourists that come for these events are in the nomenclature of the tourism business, I have learned, called heritage tourists. They generally come for an experience. They are better educated. They have more disposable wealth. They stay longer. and they are really interested in immersing themselves in the experience of the place. And from my district, that includes Fort Clatsop, I know that the preparations have been made to make sure that visitors such as your family that is moving through the wide spectrum of offerings that Oregon is going to have, whether it's activities occurring out in the Umatilla Reservation, whether it's the cargo exhibit that is now at the Gorge Discovery Center, whether it's this blockbuster exhibit in Portland, or the events that will occur up at Fort Clatsop, and now the creation of Oregon's newest national park that encompasses both sites on the Oregon side and the Washington side. Lewis and Clark had no state boundaries to guide them. The newest national park in Oregon has no state boundaries, and we have amalgamated federal holdings with state holdings and have combined this into the Lewis and Clark Memorial. I think Oregon, with no state support or modest state support, is positioning itself to be ready for the influx of exactly the kind of tourists that we want. And it has surprised me over my association with Lewis and Clark to realize the international interest in this bicentennial and the number of folks coming from all over the world that will be in Oregon at the climax of our time in the national and international spotlight, which is November of 2005. And I think that Oregon, with minimal state support, when you look at the kind of engagement that has occurred in other states, will be ready to put our game face on to host these people. And as Mr. Gregg has pointed out, the concomitant ripple benefit into the economies when they're sleeping in our hotels, eating our wonderful native offerings here, visiting Oregon, and hopefully once they've visited the Lewis and Clark Trail, we'll say, gee, maybe we ought to go look around down at Crater Lake, or maybe we ought to go look around someplace else. And I think Oregon will have our welcome mat out. So this is a great economic opportunity, and one of the flagship institutions, again at their own expense, is the Historical Society, mounting this exhibit that will draw people from all over the world.
I think that's been recognized by significant tourist industry people in Oregon as well, including we are a partner with the Heathman Hotel, for example.
Yeah, as a proof point, they stepped up and they know what this means, so they gave us $100,000, which for them is a lot of money.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. That's a segue into a question I wanted to ask at the beginning. How do you reach out to the hidden wealth? And I'm going to say hidden. Where I come from, there's some where I come from, there's some folks out there who have the financial capability of helping, but I can guarantee you very few in this building know who they are, and they're just waiting to be asked.
Well, I'm going to now turn the program over to Mrs. Paulus, who is an extraordinary fundraiser and who served at the helm of the Oregon Historical Society during a difficult transition and not only kept everything going apace, but also presided over a major expansion, all funded with private money, and has been a good friend of Oregonians everywhere. Mrs. Paulus.
Thank you. My name is Norma Paulus, for your record, and I live at 1209 Southwest 6th Avenue in Portland, Oregon. Thank you very much. It's been very nice listening to you, and particularly listening to OPB, too, and I'd like to say something just briefly about that, because it's important for legislators to know how the nonprofits work together for the benefit of a lot of things, but mostly for education. And I've worked very hard to sponsor those kinds of alliances. When I was superintendent of public instruction, I asked Maynard Orme, the director of OPB then, to partner with me in taking Steve Amon's outdoor program and making a science program and teaching particularly third grade teachers the elements of science so that they in turn could help the third graders meet their standards. They welcomed the opportunity. It was a great program. Steve Amon was very much a very good helper in that. It was a good program, a good partnership. As the director of the Oregon Historical Society, I asked Maynard Orme again to partner with me to have the living governors get together on a program, OPB television program, and have school children ask them questions. And as preparation for that, we identified teachers that were very interested in Oregon's history and political history, and then we asked them to spend 6 or 7 months educating the children on the different administrations so that the children could ask questions. That was a program that was shown over and over on OPB, but it's another example of a partnership. And then when I became director of the Historical Society, I at the same time, I asked them to use the Oregon Historical Society on the nationally known history detectives story, and we were one of the very first ones using an artifact that we've had for 150 years. So it's important for you to know that because it happens more than I think most legislators realize. It's very important to weave that fabric and to weave each of these nonprofits into the school system. As director of the Oregon Historical Society, I took a fledgling educational attempt to influence teachers and built it into what's just recently been named as the first ever national award-winning program for elementary schools by any historical entity. And the United States Library Association is having its conference in Chicago very soon, and the woman who oversees that program, who has a PhD, is going to accept the award. So these are things. We are also in the process of building a marine science program at the aquarium in connection with Oregon State. So these nonprofits are all very, very important. And the one that I think is the most important and has the greatest obligation to the citizens of this state is the Oregon Historical Society. And I'd like to remind you that in 1898 or 96, whenever it was, that the state legislature chartered us and gave us the mission of collecting and preserving and protecting and exhibiting your family's histories. It also put the governor and the state superintendent and the state librarian on the board that he now chairs. And that's been true for all those years. So we are like a part of the state, and we've met our commitment. Now let me talk to you about the money and how the society gets its money. First of all, you should all put us in your wills. I mean, that is the very first thing.
You need money now.
John Burns, who was then the chairman of the board, he had been president of the Oregon Senate as a conservative Democrat. He and his family have owned a cattle ranch in Condon for, I think, now 4 generations. He has also been the managing partner of one of the leading law firms in the state of Oregon. In late 1999, he came to me and asked me to come to the society and to do 2 things, to figure out what was wrong with it, because the board sensed that there were lots of things wrong, but no one had a handle on it, and then to raise the money to fix the problem. When I got there, had I known that the problem was as large as it was, I may not have taken the job. He was very careful not to tell me that. But fortunately, the board was very willing to really get in and help. But the first thing I had to do was to eliminate, I think, nearly 30 positions. I know it was 25 and over. Some of the positions were not missed. But most of them were serious issues. So that was the first attempt to balance the budget by the board. I also found out that my predecessor, Chet Orloff, had, working with the legislature, key legislators down here, had sought the Lewis and Clark exhibit. So that decision was made, and he secured the support of the legislative committees and different single legislators to back him up to make Portland the only venue on the West Coast to receive this enormously important exhibit. So the credit for getting the exhibit goes to Chet Orloff and key legislators. Then the problem became one of where are we going to put it? And I don't know whether you were ever in the Historical Society before the 2 or 3 years ago, but it was a rabbit warren. It was impossible to get to the exhibits or get to the library. So I realized if we were going to have this national exhibit, and so many people coming from all over that we had to change the physical structure of the building. And I asked the board to authorize the employment of an architect, and then I told them that I thought that I could raise the money for it, but we had to get right at it. The board agreed. We hired Thomas Hacker, who had worked with the various people for a long time at the Historical Society, and the former president of Nike, who was on our board then, is one of the early presidents. He took over the job of herding that plan through, and every day that we were building that building, planning it and building it, that board member was there every single day watching every penny that went into that building. And if it ever went a dollar over, it was stopped and he started. Now, that's no exaggeration. So where I got the money was going to foundations and explaining what an enormous problem we had and an enormous possibility to raise money from this exhibit. And then I went to some of our very major donors, and I was able to raise the money. Now, we can't go back to those same donors that gave us all that money. We have to wait a while before we can do that. But also, since that time, all of the major foundations in this state, every single foundation in this state, has changed their mission statement. And it's to children and education. And Betsy, I think you can... Excuse me, Senator Johnson can verify that I'm correct about that. They have all dedicated, and that is good. I like that. But that means that I can't go and ask them to help pay for this Lewis and Clark exhibit. I have to find individuals to help. So, and it's a very difficult task. And I'm going to ask you about some of those people.
Mrs. Paulus, I have a sneaking suspicion that after the picture of this precious flag and Representative Smith up next to the gold man runs all over eastern Oregon, that you may have some new cultivation opportunities.
We'll talk.
Now, I would also like to suggest to you, Representative Smith, that when your family takes this trip, you should have your children keep diaries. It would be nice if they could each keep a diary and then present them to the Oregon Historical Society.
Well, your family already has a whole pack.
I know, but your children...
I would share with you, Madam Superintendent, that our family has kept diaries since probably about 1840 to today. I still keep a diary.
Well, that's
been in our family, and I do have a question before we leave regarding those. Something may I ask this person now? How do you first? Let's take my family, who has a lot of written history, family Bibles that date back to. I have one that's 1760.
It should be at the Historical Society.
Exactly. Here's my question. What happens if a family member says, you know, I want to come in and be able to look through that and go back through the genealogy? Are they able to come
here? Oh, yes, yes. We'll
give them white gloves, but they sure can. You bet.
So they can turn it over, and then if they ever want to come back and take a look at it.
And then they would also like to take a picture of the person, the descendant, reading it. Because that's another part of the history.
But I think your question, Representative, brings us back to exactly the purpose for this informational hearing today. What motivation is there for your family member to give over this cherished, treasured piece of our regional history? If they don't feel secure in the expectation that it will be cared for commensurate with the devotion and love you have for the artifact, I think in order to encourage people to give their treasures for the benefit of the public, they have to know that they will be cared for.
I'd like to speak to that because when I was at this society and we were trying to build a new building to accommodate the Lewis and Clark crowd, what we also had to do was to sell the old Meyer and Frank warehouse where these things were housed. They were not cared for. We didn't have the right heating system. Sometimes it was very cold. Sometimes it was hot. Sometimes it was very dusty. The ventilation wasn't good. We were not doing a good job of it. That's why the board sold that building, which Tom Vaughn got for almost nothing. Tom Vaughn is the one that
is the major reason why we have most of this. But then we bought this facility that both John and Bob have talked about out in Gresham. And if you saw it, you'd think it was a warehouse for a food distribution center. That's what we want it to look like, because we don't have enough people to guard it. But it is now, we're able to preserve and keep everything the way it should be and also catalog it. We're raising money to catalog and digitize it so it can be put on the web and sold.
Well, let me ask
follow-up, Representative Smith.
Let's go back to my earlier question. I come from a very rural part of the state, northeast Oregon. But between redistricting and where I am now, I've represented 13 counties. And I know there's some people there who have contributed to me, have contributed to other people who have the ability, without blinking, to write a check for $100,000. You would never guess it. I'd never guess it. If you saw them walking down Main Street Heppner, you'd want to hand them a dollar, you know, so you'd know they'd have a cup of coffee for the day. How do we reach out to those people?
Well, we'd like to meet with you.
Yeah.
I would very much like to.
Yeah, and we have board members, too, and in different parts of the state. But, you know, if we're really flexible and inventive for finding access points and then for doing it the right way so that it's that they feel that they're partners with us and doing something important for the state. So
nothing tells the story like allowing people proximity to these treasures. And I think working with the professional staff at the Historical Society, you could easily make the opportunity for some of these folks who not only have the financial capability but also maybe have the treasures to come and build a relationship, find out where their things would be kept, under what terms and conditions they would be accepted on behalf of the state of Oregon, and bring them and allow them to go through the warehouse and see the things that are there. I know that the development folks would make every accommodation.
Yes.
Well, I want to make sure that we leave ample opportunity for anyone else in the audience who has come today to testify. To do so, I would invite you to make your closing remarks. We're nearing the end of the time that the committee has, and so Dr. Pierce or Mrs. Paulus, Mr. Gregg, if you'd like to wrap up, I would invite you to do so.
All of us, the people who work at the Oregon Historical Society, the members of the board, the constituents, have a deep and fundamental commitment to the mission of what we do, and not just for its intrinsic value, but also because of the service that we perform for the state and the people of Oregon. We believe we do it very well, and we are dedicated to continuing that quality through the coming decades, and we invite you and the state to rejoin us in that mission.
Thank you very much. I think you have heard from the panel today a bipartisan, bicameral outreach to the cultural institutions of our state. If in this budget crisis we leave the cultural landscape denuded, we will have done a great disservice to Oregonians. Any concluding remarks, Mrs. Paulus or Mr. Gregg?
I'd like to say one thing to Representative Smith, since you're going up above. The single greatest accomplishment in my entire life was the day that I put some gold on the nose of the gold man.
Oh, no.
I was so acrophobic, I was absolutely terrified. But the television station came to have the governor do it. They were regilding him, and they had a scaffolding that went up there. And the governor's secretary said, oh, he's far too busy. I think he's acrophobic also. And then they went, David Frohnmayer was attorney general, and he was in Portland, and Clay Myers wasn't here. And when they came to me, it was the last thing I thought I could do. But I knew if I didn't, I'd be the one that was the wimp. So I walked out and told them that if they'd wait till I went home and put some trousers on and tennis shoes, that I'd be happy to do it. And I ran down the basement, and at that time we had an international weightlifter down there that had shoulders like this, Doyle Kennedy, Ramona's husband. I rushed down, found him, and I said, are you afraid of heights? And he said, no. And I said, I've got to do this, and the only way I can do it is you're the only one strong enough to catch me if I faint. And he said, it's a piece of cake. I've already been up there. So I said, all you have to do is pretend like you're on my staff and follow me up there. If you're right behind me, I'll be able to do it. And they had the column, and they had the ladder not like this, so that you could look at. It was like this to minimize the damage to the column. And I got up there, and I have a picture of myself that Ron Blankenbaker took, because he wasn't afraid of heights. He followed me up. And I looked, you know, if you threw a cat against a screen door. But I did it.
Well, that's Exhibit A on a piece of oral history.
That's right.
It gives testimony to why we ought to have a place to keep all of that stuff. Thank you very much for coming.
I'm going to do a little bit of history myself.
And while the signing is going on, I will invite anyone in the audience. We did not have a sign-up sheet today, but I would invite anyone in the audience willing to offer testimony to make their presence known. We do have a sign-in sheet. Forgive me.
They wouldn't let me bring it. I have the handwritten. We have the handwritten preamble to
right.
the state constitution.
I know you do. I just thought maybe it was in that box. I didn't want you to leave without me seeing it.
No, they didn't.
Dallas, has anyone signed up?
The folks from OPB.
Okay, then we have no other people wishing to testify. Thank you for coming. Thank you for bringing these treasures. Former co-chair Van Vliet, thank you for coming on behalf of Oregon Public Broadcasting.
Thank you for your great testimony.
And with that, I am closing the...